I might quote many similar instances, going to show that the transportation of material objects, sometimes from very remote places, is not an uncommon circumstance in the experience of those who have investigated the phenomena of spiritualism, but these will suffice. From what has already been related of the Eddy mediums in my preceding chapters, it will occasion no surprise, when I state that on many occasions, if the testimony of eyewitnesses may be accepted, objects have been dropped on the chit-tendon circle room floor, or laid in the hands of persons in attendance. I have seen, among other things, a large stone, weighing some 60 pounds, a cartwheel, two large mother-of-pearl shells, an ear of Egyptian corn, said to have come from a mummy's tomb, a specimen of a rare mineral, a gold vest chain, a heavy gold ring, two small spotted shells, a miniature ivory die for a watch charm, a small quartz crystal, and a cut white Carnelian seal stone that was said to have been brought by invisible carriers. The crystal and Carnelian were placed in my own hand at two different, dark circles, but it happened in the dark, and so I cannot vouch for their genuineness, any more than I can for that of either of the other articles. Horatio Eddy tells me that he has been the frequent recipient of these ghostly attentions. Once George Dix put a spotted snake on his bed, once he brought him a $5 bill to give to one Riley Allen, a sick neighbor, once a bill of like amount for a Mr. Barker, once a sum of money to defray a child's funeral expenses, and once, for himself, a silver-mounted pistol, the seven barrels of which were all loaded except one, which the spirit discharged himself, frightening Horatio out of his wits with the idea that burglars were in the room. One gentleman whom I met at the Eddy homestead, told me of an instance within his own knowledge, in which seven different communications were written, on an equal number of pieces of paper of as many different colors, and sewed, each with silk of a color to match the paper, upon a child's pocket handkerchief. Strangest of all, upon each paper was stitched a lock of hair, purporting to be that of the spirit writing the communication, and which they alleged they brought from their own graves. As some of them had been dead many years, the latter assertion may be taken for what it is worth. Another gentleman visitor asserts that, last January, at his request, he had brought to him some new potatoes, which must have come from afar, as the snow lay deep over the whole of this northern country. I am witness to the fact that one evening in October, at a dark circle, a lady who had brought as a present for Mayflower, a picture of a bunch of roses, painted upon a Bristol board sheet of, say, 8 by 12 inches, had it taken from her hand, and after the circle it could not be found, although I searched the room thoroughly. Citizens of Utica will recognize in the signature attached to the following document, the name of one of their most estimable fellow townsmen, a man of high character for probity and truthfulness, Chittenden, October 21, 1874. Dear Sir, please add to what you have already published, the fact that, at a circle held in the lower sitting room of the Eddy homestead, on the evening of August 27, 1873, the doors and windows being closed and sealed, a stone weighing 64 pounds, was suddenly dropped at my feet. I had noticed the same stone lying outside the house during the day. George Ralph, Utica, N.Y. But I doubt if any circle ever witnessed a more astonishing spiritual feat than that which I am about to relate. The evening of October 24th was as bright as day with the light of the moon, and, while there was a good deal of moisture in the air, the atmospheric conditions would, I suppose, have been regarded as favorable for manifestations. In the dark circle, as soon as the light was extinguished, George Dix, addressing me, Dublovitsky, said, Madame, I am now about to give you a test of the genuineness of the manifestations in this circle, which I think will satisfy not only you, but a skeptical world beside. I shall place in your hands the buckle of a medal of honor worn in life by your brave father, and buried with his body in Russia. This has been brought to you by your uncle, whom you have seen materialized this evening. Presently I heard the lady utter an exclamation, and, a light being struck, we all saw me, Dubby, holding in her hand a silver buckle of a most curious shape, which she regarded with speechless wonder. When she recovered herself a little, she announced that this buckle had, indeed, been worn by her father, with many other decorations, that she identified this particular article by the fact that the point of the pin had been carelessly broken off by herself many years ago, and that, according to universal custom, this, with all his other medals and crosses, must have been buried with her father's body. The medal to which this buckle belongs, was one granted by the late Tsar to his officers, after the Turkish campaign of 1828. The medals were distributed at Bucharest, and a number of the officers had buckles similar to this made by the rude silversmiths of that city. Her father died July 15, 1873, and she, being in this country, could not attend his obsequies. As to the authenticity of this present, so mysteriously received, she possessed ample proof, in a photographic copy of her father's oil portrait, in which this very buckle appears, attached to its own ribbon and medal. It will be imagined that I felt a deep anxiety to see the picture in question, and later, my desire was gratified. In this chapter, I now am able to present to the reader sketches of the spirits present, and the whole decoration, the former copied from life, the latter from the photograph. Both are drawn larger than the natural size, and the inscription on the medal has been furnished by me, D.B. herself. Was there ever a manifestation more wonderful than this? A token dug by unknown means from a father's grave and laid in his daughter's hand, 5,000 miles away, across an ocean, a jewel from the breast of a warrior sleeping his last sleep in Russian ground, sparkling in the candlelight in a gloomy apartment of a Vermont farmhouse. A precious present from the tomb of her nearest and best beloved of kin, to be kept as a perpetual proof that death can neither extinguish the ties of blood nor long divide those who were once united and desire reunion with one another. I kept a minute of the time in William's materializing circle that evening. It began at 7:10 p.m., and closed at 8:05. In the intervening 65 minutes, 11 different spirit forms appeared. Honto remained in sight 5 minutes, old Mr. Brown 2.5 minutes, Chester Packard 18 seconds, William his brother 17 seconds. The intervals between the appearances of some of the forms, were respectively 4 minutes 45 seconds, 3:10, 2:47, 1:13 and 1 minute. Mrs. Eddy's spirit appeared and addressed us, saying some friendly words to me personally, from within the cabinet. Her last sentences grew fainter and fainter, as though she were receding from us farther and farther, until her voice was lost in the distance. Among the most noticeable forms to present themselves, was one who seemed to be either a Hindukuli or an Arab athlete. He was dark-skinned, of short stature, a lean, wiry, active form, with no more superfluous fat on his frame than has a greyhound in working condition. The artist, writing to me of him, says, "He left a more vivid impression on my mind than any other spirit. I can see him now, perfectly long, mere bone and sinew, with a cat-like suppleness. For dress, a closely fitting vest, seemingly cotton, drawers tucked into what might have been socks or gaiters, a sash about his loins, and upon his head a dark red handkerchief. He came to visit me, Dublovitsky, and made her a profound obeisance, but she failed to recognize him. Nevertheless, she showed no such hesitancy about another of her visitors. The curtain was lifted, and out stepped a gentleman of so marked an appearance as to make it absurd to imagine that William Eddy could be attempting to personate a character in this instance. He was a portly personage, with an unmistakable air of high breeding, dressed in an evening suit of black cloth, with a frilled white shirt and frilled wristbands. About his neck he wore the Greek cross of St. Anne, attached to its appropriate ribbon. At first me, D.B., thought that her father stood before her. But, as the figure advanced another step or two towards her, thus bringing himself to within 5 or 6 feet of where she sat, the spirit greeted her in the Russian language, and said, "Ja, uncle." She then recognized the familiar features of her father's brother, to whom he bore a very strong resemblance in life. This was M. Gustav H. Hahn, late president of the criminal court at Grodno, Russia, which dignified office he held for 12 years. This gentleman, who died in 1861, must not be confounded with his namesake and cousin, Count Gustav Hahn, the senator, who is living in St. Petersburg at the present moment. Chapter 23, Tests Continued. Of all Mr. Crook's statements concerning his 3 years' experiences with the spirit Katie King, none excited more wonder than that about his being allowed to cut off a lock of her hair. The very idea that so immaterial a thing as a spirit has something less substantial than the very wind that blows, a breath, a hazy vapor, which, even when seen by mortal eye, has seemed no more solid than the mist of morning, that this unsubstantial nothing should not only be able to exert dynamic energies, but hand over to the bold philosopher a ringlet cut from her own head, as a maiden might give a dress to her lover, was on its face absurd. But, nevertheless, it was true, and the same favor has been extended to several others, by this and other spirits. I have already stated that I saw the Witch of the Mountain give one of her grisly locks to Judge Bacon, and the incident related above, in this chapter, tells of 7 different keepsakes of the same kind being given by the spirits, at one time, to one person. The artist in one of his sketches represents old Mrs. Cleveland in the act of cutting a lock from Honto's head. I know of at least 3 different persons to whom Honto gave pieces of her own flair, a portion of one of which I have now in my possession. It is of a stiff, wiry texture, entirely free from grey, and has been fully identified by an expert of 20 years' experience in the manufacture of hair goods, as of Indian origin. His affidavit is as follows: State of Vermont, S.S. County of Rutland. Henry Williams, being duly sworn, deposes and says that he is a native of New York City, a hair worker by trade. That he worked 4 years for Rufus, of Chatham Street, New York, the largest hair manufacturer in the said city, and 10 years for Edward Farlon, also of the said city. Altogether, he has had 20 years' experience in the manufacture of hair, and is so familiar with the hair of various kinds used in the trade, as to be able to detect the nationality and quality of any specimen exhibited to him. And deponent, having been allowed to examine a specimen of hair shown him by Mr. H. S. Altcourt, and designated as No. I, declares the same to be of Indian origin, and from its length and quality, must have been taken from the head of a squaw. The sample marked number 2, deponent cut himself from the head of an Indian squaw in the city of Albany, N.Y., on the 16th instant, at the request of said Olcott, for purposes of comparison. Specimen number 3, deponent says, is American hair. The specimen number 1 he would know anywhere as Indian, and he cannot be mistaken as to the fact. Henry Williams. Witness, M. L. Salisbury, State of Vermont, S.S. County of Rutland. Personally appeared Henry Williams, of Rutland, County of Rutland, State of Vermont, to me known, and made oath to the above affidavit, this 9th day of December, 1874. G. R. Bottom, Notary Public. The specimen number 1 referred to is the lock purporting to have been cut from Honto's head. Specimen number 2 was cut by Mr. Williams, at my request, from the head of an Indian woman, who lives, during the winter months, in Albany, N.Y., and in summer goes into camp with her tribe. Specimen number 3 was cut by me from William Eddy's head. I submitted the 1st and 3rd specimens to the expert without explanation, and his judgment was given upon them immediately after they came into his hands. When he pronounced number 1 Indian hair, I tried to discourage the idea, by suggesting that it was taken from some old wig, or from the forelock of a colt's head, but he persisted, and said he would make his affidavit to the fact of its real origin, in any court, at any time. I may also mention the rather interesting circumstance, that, a few days since, I handed this Honto hair to a boy clairvoyant, 14 years of age, and the son of a physician, who instantly said, "Why, this hair came from a spirit's head." I said, "Nonsense. How could I get hair from a spirit's head?" To which he replied, "I don't know. But this did come from a spirit, and there she is, in that room, smiling at me, and holding her hair out for me to compare this with. It's the same, identical hair." I said, "I see no spirit. If she is here, ask her name." The lad conversed with great earnestness with the invisible presence, and finally said, Pahontas? What do you say it is?
Ah. Yes, Honto, that's it. She says it is Honto. She gave it to another man, and he gave it to you.
Now, I had not mentioned a word concerning the hair to the boy, or anyone else in the room. In fact, I had never exchanged a word with him before. The hair was in my locket, and taken out and handed to him without comment. The theory of mind reading is sufficient, perhaps, to account for the incident, but as it is interesting in this connection, I relate it. Another of the series of mechanical experiments attempted by me was suggested by Mr. Crook's first article in his quarterly. He said, the spiritualist tells of rooms and houses being shaken even to injury by superhuman power. The man of science merely asks for a pendulum to be set vibrating when it is in a glass case and supported on solid masonry. It occurred to me that in the absence of the means to try so conclusive an experiment as this, I might at least get the spirits to ring a bell under a glass cover, and I was promised that this should be done. Accordingly, on the evening of October 12th, in the light circle that followed William's materializing séance, I placed my small table gong upon a tambourine, and inverted a tumbler over it. I was not allowed to hold the tambourine myself, and so, in my eyes, all value in the experiment as a scientific test was destroyed. William Eddy took my place, and I was asked to step a little back. The light was then ordered to be lowered, and we waited for some minutes in silence. At length I heard a faint sound as of the bell struck inside the tumbler. It was almost inaudible, but still an unmistakable sound, and while we listened it was repeated twice almost as feebly. But finally the little bell rang out twice so that all could hear it, and all agreed that the sound came from within the tumbler. This inconclusive result of what should have been an interesting experiment, is of a piece with many things that happened to me in the course of my long and wearisome investigation at the Eddy House. So far from the importance of my labor being recognized, and all reasonable facilities afforded, I was kept constantly at a distance, as though I were an enemy instead of an unprejudiced observer. As to the family realizing any feeling of gratitude for my disinterested defense of their character before the public, the idea apparently never crossed their minds. On the contrary, I was constantly made to feel that my toleration as a member of the household was a favor for which I should be grateful, and all the kind and polite treatment I could give them, individually and collectively, scarcely availed to make them grant me one favor more than they bestowed upon any visitor. Other persons of both sexes, strangers to them, were at different times permitted to sit close to the platform, upon it, and within 2 feet of the cabinet door, to shake hands with Honto, to dance with her, to look into her very eyes, feel her hair, and measure heights with her, while I never enjoyed one of these favors. I never had a private séance under test conditions, and a dozen simple but crucial tests, reflecting in no wise upon the honor of the mediums, but calculated to place them in an honorable light, and satisfy the most doubting skeptic of the genuineness of the phenomena, were not even mentioned by me, for fear that I might get my dismissal before my work was done. It was this state of things that kept me in that gloomy house, amid such unpleasant conditions, 2 months, to get what I might and ought to have secured in 2 weeks. I stayed and bore everything because, having once undertaken to accomplish a given thing, it was not my nature to abandon the task while life remained. I have said this much in no spirit of complaint, but only from a sense of justice to all concerned, to myself, because the public should know that I have neither been favored beyond others nor have any personal preferences to gratify in saying what has been said in favor of these Eddy boys, to the mediums, because it seems to me that if they were nothing but common tricksters, their first impulse would have been to curry favor with me and try to influence the tone of my writing. I have also been prompted to this explanation by the fact that various newspapers have given their readers to understand that a greater reliance might be placed upon my story, from the fact that my intimacy with the Edds, and the superior facilities granted me, put me, as it were, inside the ring, and I had seen, heard, and felt more than any ordinary observer could possibly have done. For what I have seen, heard, or felt,
I am in no wise indebted to the favor of the Eddy family, but simply to fair natural powers of observation, supplemented by a sort of grim, bulldog stubbornness, and a determination to do impartial justice, that kept me at a post I had once assumed. But it affords me pleasure whenever I receive evidence from disinterested persons that is corroborative of the genuineness of the Eddy manifestations. I am more than willing to have my personal prejudices against the brothers, as individuals, overborne by proofs of their real mediumistic powers. Of such a nature, is the following certificate from a well-known architect of Hartford, who visited Chittenden a 12-month since, Hartford, Connecticut, December 24, 1874, Col. H. S. Olgut. Dear Sir, in answer to your request for a statement from me of what I saw at the Eds, in Chittenden, I have this to say: my first and only visit to those remarkable mediums was in the fall of 1873. I attended the light and dark seances held during 3 evenings. The facilities afforded me for close and careful investigation were unusually good. It was my privilege to examine William Eddy on 2 occasions before he entered the cabinet, which was an old closet, off the south room, clown stairs, and under the stairs. In my examination of Mr. Eddy's person, just before his entering the closet, I went as far as a decent regard for propriety would permit. I removed his coat, unbuttoned his vest, placed my hands beneath the waistband of his pants, and fully satisfied myself that all the clothing he had about him was his usual farm dress, a brown check gingham shirt, coat, pants, and vest. Any person after making such an examination as I did, could have but one conclusion, and that William Eddy could not possibly have concealed about his person the different costumes that were afterwards seen during the seances. The closet being examined before and after the seance, and nothing found but its bare walls, the idea of trickery on the part of William Eddy was too silly to be entertained for one moment. The closet has been often described by different writers. I did not measure it, but judge its size to be 4 by 8 feet. It was evidently plastered when the house was built, rather coarsely done, the marks of the trowel being plainly seen, flushed down with the baseboards, which were perhaps 7 inches wide. The floor was the same undisturbed old work, put down when the house was erected. To talk of panels, traps, or possible openings where a confederate could assist, is worse than nonsense. Nothing of the kind could possibly be there without being detected by an experienced architect like myself. If costumes were taken in there, it must have been when from 15 to 20 individuals were looking at the door, and as I sat directly opposite and within 10 feet of it, I can safely say that such a thing was impossible. The different costumes seen during the 3 evenings of my stay would have filled a large-sized Saratoga trunk. The first object seen each night, and that in less than 10 seconds after William Eddy had disappeared behind the shawl which hung over the door, was a clean, white, naked hand and arm, thrust out from behind the shawl. It was evidently a lady's hand and arm. Honto made her appearance next, on each evening. The second night she lighted a friction match which had been placed in the closet for her use, and held the blazing stick directly before her face so that every person in the room saw her Indian face with perfect distinctness. 369. After retiring behind the shawl, an Indian woman next appeared, dressed entirely different and in the exact costume of the squaws of the St. Regis tribe. This was a striking and sudden change, and a very remarkable incident withal. The dress was a blue petticoat or underskirt, with a yellow border around the bottom, and a yellow stripe woven into the cloth, 6 or 7 inches above, moccasins, leggings, and the usual tape windings around and above the ankles, were all to be seen. It was not Honto, but some other Indian maiden. The change of costume must have been made in less than 1 minute, if it was a trick. The forms of men neatly dressed in black, came out, with their white linen bosoms and cuffs plain enough to be seen, to satisfy all that they were not William Eddy, whoever else they might be. One person, nearly half a head taller than William Eddy, came out, and was recognized by several people from Rutland. I saw the features plainly of several persons, who, Had I ever known them, I could have recognized at once, my position being so near, and being fortunately blessed with good eyes. In Horatio's light seance, it was my privilege to sit for the ring test. I positively know the ring was in a gentleman's hand in front of me, when I prepared for the test by taking Horatio's right hand in my right, and his left hand in my left. I am particular about this, for the reason that I have seen the performance differently described. The gentleman holding the ring passed it up, and I saw, while holding both of Horatio's hands, a hand above the curtain take the ring from the gentleman, and with a sudden shudder on the part of Horatio, the ring flew from his right arm, onto mine with such force, that it hurt me severely, as it struck the joint of my thumb in passing over. A guitar lying in my lap, the strings all in sight, and a lamp burning on the table within 3 feet of myself, played a correct and lively accompaniment to several dance tunes, whistled by a party present. The head of the instrument was held by Horatio's muffled hand, but the strings were struck in the usual place, directly over the hole in the body of the instrument. I could plainly distinguish that as the point of greatest vibration, and also see flashes of electrical light on the strings. I saw an iron or steel ring fall from Horatio's arm in the broad light. His arms were bound tightly behind his back. The ring was most assuredly on his arm, or else a dozen witnesses didn't know what they saw. A sudden shudder came through him, but no perceptible motion of his hands or arms, and the ring fell upon the floor, and rolled some distance away. These are a few of the essential points I fully and distinctly remember. Truly yours, S. W. Lincoln. Me. Dublovitsky playing the parlor organ, with Honto as a spectator at very close quarters. Among the latest and the most startling phases of the manifestations, is the actual playing upon a parlor organ by the materialized spirit girl Honto, herself. The first instance of the kind occurred on the evening of October 27. Mr. Ralph, of Utica, Mr. Pritchard, of Albany, and old Mrs. Cleveland, were all sitting on the platform that evening, but were requested to take their seats among the audience, and the benches were ordered pushed a little further back than usual. Honto then reappeared. She had been out before doing some of her usual tricks, examined the instrument with attention, and, with one foot working the pedal, played a few notes. She then retired to the cabinet, reappeared, and, taking a chair that Mr. Ralph placed for her, sat down and played a wild, disconnected melody as an accompaniment to her voice. This being her first attempt at singing, the effect was weird in the extreme. Her notes were harsh, wailing, and discordant, and it was almost enough to freeze one's blood to hear it. She repeated this performance 4 times that evening, and it has been a feature of each night's séance up to the present time. On the evening of the 21st instant, I saw her dance, play the organ, smoke a cigar, make a lot of shawls and tissues, dance a jig with Horatio, take a bracelet from a lady visitor as a present, and heard her sing. Surely, enough for one spirit to do at one performance, a leading woman in a variety show could hardly be asked for more. Chapter 24, Pseudo-Investigators. The first time I attended a dark circle at the Edis, I contracted a feeling of real affection for the little child spirit, real or imaginary, known as Mayflower. Her music was so sweet and full of expression. Her poetical attempts evinced so tender a regard for the beautiful in nature, her conversation was so childlike and innocent, she seemed actuated by so strong a sentiment of charity and broad compassion for all who came, that I could not help loving her, or, at least, the ideal child whom I pictured to myself as standing in our presence in the darkened chamber. I think that a love of children and all their ways is one of the strongest traits of my disposition, and it may be well that in this matter of Mayflower's identity I allowed myself to become the willing dupe of my imagination. Possibly there is no such creature as she, and her voice, her speech, and her sentiments are only parts of a clever imposture. I have never seen her, nor felt more than her hand, or a hand of the size that I should suppose such a child as she might have. And I have no proof to cite in support of her individual existence, beyond the certificate of the two little girls, already published. I have no conclusive evidence to offer a scientific investigator that she ever spoke a word, or drew a breath, or took a step, and if my reason could be satisfied upon certain points, I would be ready to admit that every feature of these dark circles may be a trick.